ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the government unveils its latest defence strategy, with hundreds of billions of dollars to be spent over the next decade. Also, organisers of the Brisbane Olympics face tough questions about their progress in planning the event, and investigators continue their search for those who attacked police and paramedics after the alleged stabbing at a Sydney church.
In some of the footage, you've seen people, you know, actively climbing onto police cars, breaking the police car windows, etc. And those people, when they'll be easier to identify when they're isolated from the group.
First this evening, Australia is to spend an extra $50 billion on defence over the next decade. The Defence Minister, Richard Marles, made the announcement today while releasing the government's long-awaited National Defence Strategy. He also announced the government is changing some of its priority purchases. Andrew Green is the ABC's defence correspondent. Andrew, what are the key features of the documents released today?
Overall, there will be a bigger spend on defence than had been previously committed to by the Labor government. There are a lot of numbers that have been thrown around today, but some of the key figures: for the next decade, Labor is proposing to spend an extra $50 billion for defence, but it's also, as part of today's announcement, reprioritising, as it puts it, around $72 billion worth of spending. So some projects are either being reduced or scrapped altogether, but others are receiving big boosts. Now, defence spending overall under this plan is expected to reach 2.4% of Australia's GDP in a decade. So by 2033-34, the defence spending overall as a proportion of Australia's economy is going to be well above 2% where it is now. The minister, the Defence Minister, Richard Marles, says the immediate priority is long-range strikes, so missiles, but also autonomous systems, so drones, that sort of thing that can do remote work. Let's hear from the Defence Minister, Richard Marles, as he addressed the National Press Club and released two documents, the National Defence Strategy, but also the new Integrated Investment Program.
These increases will see annual defence spending almost double over the next 10 years to $100 billion in the financial year 33-34. It will see defence spending as a proportion of gross domestic product projected to increase to around 2.4% by 2033-34.
And Andrew, how's the opposition responded to these announcements?
Well, like everybody, the opposition is still trying to work through all the documents and what these exact spending decisions mean. But from the outset, the Shadow Defence Minister, Andrew Hastie, has been very critical of Richard Marles from a communication point of view. He says that the minister has failed to articulate clearly to the Australian people what the threat is that this country could face in the next couple of years or even in the next decade. He also wanted to point out that there were projects that were being cut. But overall, as we've heard from the minister, there is an increase in defence spending from what Labor inherited, but also what it intended to do when it first came to office. In any case, Andrew Hastie was concentrating on the projects that were cut, and this is what he had to say.
Under the Albanese government, the ADF will be worse off. There won't be a balanced force or a focus force. There will instead be a weaker force.
So what are some of the projects that are being cut?
These details are gradually getting out. They haven't been released in a public sense. We don't have a document that outlines them, but there are a few interesting things we've been able to pick up this afternoon. The Joint Strike Fighter project, the F-35, it's had a long and perhaps controversial history in Australia. Well, At present, Australia has bought 72 of those advanced aircraft, and today we learn that a decision on buying any more has essentially been put off and perhaps will never be made. So Australia, instead of getting 100 F-35s, will probably sit with the current number of 72. That means that Australia is going to extend the life of its Joint Strike, as rather its Super Hornets, and the Growler aircraft, the electronic attack aircraft, they are also going to be upgraded. So that's one decision that has been made as part of the changes to the integrated investment program. Also learning that some supply ships that had been committed to under the coalition, they will no longer go ahead. These are replenishment vessels that were to support the Navy. So there's a couple of other upgrades to various defence facilities that have also been scrapped as part of today's announcements.
Andrew Green is the ABC's defence correspondent. New South Wales police have arrested a 19-year-old Sydney man after officers were attacked by an angry mob following an alleged knife attack at a Western Sydney church on Monday night, and they're confident more arrests are imminent. People rushed to the Assyrian Orthodox Christian Church after a 16-year-old allegedly stabbed its bishop, who was conducting a service being broadcast online. One police officer suffered a broken jaw in the melee, and paramedics say they were forced to hole up in the church for their own safety. As Angus Randall reports, the shocking emergencies at both the church and Bondi Junction highlight the dangers first responders face.
While paramedics treat a stabbing victim inside the Good Shepherd Church in Western Sydney, outside a crowd of hundreds smashes police cars. New South Wales Police Commissioner Karen Webb says those who are involved can expect a knock on their door.
We are working through that. There are some people we've identified and they can expect to be arrested in the next day or so.
Two police officers were injured during the riot. One suffered a broken jaw. Police say projectiles were thrown at officers, property was stolen, and at least 10 police vehicles were damaged. Commissioner Webb was at Fairfield Police Station in Sydney's West yesterday, where the identification process is ongoing.
We had crime scene officers fingerprinting and DNA testing the police vehicles to identify people from that. Whether that's one form of evidence, there's certainly a lot of CCTV footage and police helicopter video that we'll compile and go through painstakingly to identify those who have broken the law and assaulted police.
Associate Professor Xanthi Mallett is a criminologist at Griffith University. She says social media is a huge source of intelligence for police.
A lot of videos were being posted online almost in real time as to what happened. They'll look at church membership, and also there were obviously a lot of media there who would have captured footage. So it's just about identifying those individuals captured in that footage who they believe may have broken the law.
Are there particular challenges around such a chaotic crime scene?
Certainly, with so many people there and so much movement, it's going to be possibly difficult to identify who is exactly doing what. But in some of the footage, you've seen people, you know, actively climbing onto police cars, breaking the police car windows, etc. And those people, when they'll be easier to identify when they're isolated from the group. But, you know, the police will be diligent in this. You can't have this kind of mass social unrest. So they will try and track down as many people as possible. It may take some time to identify those individuals, but they will certainly endeavour to identify as many as possible that were causing that unrest.
Riots are rare in Australia, and prosecutions are even rarer. After the Cronulla riots in 2005, police charged 104 people, but only a handful were convicted. Xanthi Mallett says police will consider its limited resources in pursuing offenders.
A lot of resources could be swallowed up by trying to identify these individuals when obviously policing resources are going to be stretched at the moment anyway because of increases in, you know, security risks and increasing in policing just kind of on the ground to provide that safety to the community. So I think that they will be choosing their battles, as it were, in terms of how much resources they'll be put into identifying them. But if there's been serious criminal activity, serious harm, for example, then that's absolutely something the police will want to look at very carefully.
And ultimately, a crackdown on a community in shock may cause more unrest.
Yeah, I think they do have to be careful. They have to, you know, tread with care because obviously that particular community is feeling literally attacked, feeling at risk. There are quite a small Assyrian community in that particular area in Wakeley. And I think the police, there is a certain amount of concern that they have to be protecting the public and obviously targeting those who are breaking the law but don't want to further marginalise or cause harm to any particular group. So they do have to tread very carefully.
New South Wales Ambulance says paramedics treated 30 people in the crowd on Monday night, but some were forced to shelter in the church over threats to their safety. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says emergency services must be allowed to do their job. James Maskey is from Fortum Australia, which offers support to first responders.
The compounding nature of these incidents, so quickly one from the next, really highlights that this work is dangerous and it does have a personal cost associated in terms of the mental health and well-being to those who respond, to those who are at home, their families, and the community more broadly. It also underscores the imperative of supporting those who support us. However, there is a high rate of stigma, both personal and organisational stigma, across the country in terms of accessing internal services from agencies. So first responders and their families must be empowered to receive supports in a way that resonates with them.
Many first responders may go through their entire career without attending something as traumatic as an alleged terrorist incident or mass murder. But James Maskey says the daily stresses can easily build up.
It is often not the large-scale incidents that have the biggest impact upon the well-being of our vital first responders. It's the day-to-day, it's the cumulative exposure to micro-stresses, to micro-traumas, but also macro-traumas that compounds and enhances, I guess, the mental health prevalence of first responders in terms of their mental health diagnosis and suicidality, but also how they're travelling in any given moment.
First responders will remain on high alert across Sydney over the next few days. Bondi Junction Shopping Centre will reopen tomorrow for a community reflection day before resuming normal trading hours with an increased security presence from Friday.
Angus Randall. The Queensland government is trying to get past months of angry debate about its plans for the 2032 Olympics by setting up an independent authority to deliver the event. But questions remain about how the rollout of the Games is being managed. A Senate inquiry has heard the government still considering whether it's made the right choice for its main Olympic stadium, despite confidently declaring it's the best option. Stephanie Smale has more.
This year's Paris Olympics are only months away, but big questions remain about the delays in starting Brisbane's transformation into an Olympic city. Deep division over venues for the 2032 Games continues, and a Senate committee is looking into the situation. National Senator Matt Canavan asked the head of Queensland State Development Department, Graham Frayne, how the main Olympic stadium was picked over a range of others. He admitted work is still underway to figure out whether it's a smart move.
How can we assure ourselves that this is a good value for money?
Indeed. Thank you, Senator. And in fact, that is the work that we are now commencing on a project validation report for CUSAC.
Aren't we shooting first and asking questions later?
To help ease the political heat in the Olympic debate, the Queensland government has moved to set up an independent Olympic delivery authority, with legislation to make it happen introduced today. Its first big job will be to lock in transport projects, but it looks like there will be more delays there too, with Graham Frayne telling Senator Bridget McKenzie it could take another year and a half to lock in what's needed and where.
Even if we pass the bill today, yes. It is 18 months additional.
Within 18 months, yes.
That will be handed down sometime in 2026. Then we need to procure contracts for construction, talk to communities who will be impacted.
Yes. As I mentioned.
And the long runway that the new norms were supposed to deliver this community and this country about buy-in and legacy have completely eroded.
But Mr. Frayne has assured the committee a number of big transport projects are already underway. The committee was made up of political opponents of the Queensland government today, with Liberal, Nationals and Green senators asking the questions. Olympic veteran John Coates also gave evidence, repeating his personal take on how the public views the toing and froing.
We're on the nose. It's dropped as low as 40%. I've got a good smell for this sort of thing.
Liberal Senator Anne Rustin quizzed Mr Coates about the so-called new norm ideal to use existing venues and reduce spending as much as possible.
We had 83% of the venues in place, and we had the remaining that could be put in place through upgrading or a new plan such as the Brisbane Arena.
My question was, how many Olympic events could be held in Brisbane or Queensland today?
83%.
There's still a lot of work to do, though, billions of dollars worth, in fact, to deliver stadium upgrades for the opening and closing ceremonies and to host athletics. John Coates, who's a board member of the Brisbane Olympic Organising Committee, denies he was involved in picking venues in an official capacity. But he's told the committee he was in contact with the Queensland government and made it clear he wasn't a fan of an expensive brand new stadium in inner Brisbane.
The Olympic Movement's position on Victoria Park was, you can go ahead and build Victoria Park if that's what the city needs and you can afford that, but that's not to be ticked off as an Olympic cost. If we can do CUSAC at $1.6 billion, then that's what we should be doing.
Olympic historian Dr. Richard Barker says despite the angry debate over delays, there's plenty of time to deliver a good Games. He says setting up a coordination authority for the Sydney Games was a good move.
As a result of that, they linked up everything and the facilities were all built and the transport was sorted out and the Olympic Games and the Paralympic Games were held very successfully.
Dr. Barker says October's state election could change the Olympic landscape yet again, but he says it's unlikely the Games won't happen, however they're delivered.
There's no question Australia can't run a fantastic Games. Both the Melbourne and Sydney Games prove that we've got, you know, the expertise and the manpower and the Olympic history to run a fantastic set of Games. We're just toing and froing. Those recommendations by in the Quirk report, what did we say? 27 of the 30 were agreed to. There's only a few that weren't.
The Queensland government says the Independent Olympic Delivery Authority should be up and running by the middle of the year.
Stephanie Smale reporting. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, mystery surrounds the death of a woman at a Victorian wellness retreat. The United States is slapping more sanctions on Iran as punishment for its weekend attack on Israel. The Americans and their allies are hoping to thwart a major conflict by dissuading Israel from pushing ahead with any military reprisal against Iran. But Israel's top general isn't dampening the tension. He's warning the attack won't go unanswered. Rachel Mealy reports.
It's a demonstration of brinkmanship with the highest possible stakes. Israel's top army general Herzi Halevi says his country will respond to the Iranian assault.
We are closely assessing the situation. We remain at our highest level of readiness. Iran will face the consequences for its actions. We will choose our response accordingly.
Iran says Saturday's drone and missile attack was in direct retaliation for Israel's bombing of its consulate in Syria. It's not considering any further actions unless it's pushed again. Iran's foreign minister is Hossein Amir Abdullahian.
If the Israeli regime makes a mistake, this time Iran's response, as Iran's military commanders have already announced, will not be minimal. It will be immediate and severe.
Foreign ministers in the European Union held an emergency meeting to discuss the repercussions of the attack. The EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, urged Israel and Iran to step back from the abyss.
We remain united in the objective of avoid further escalation and call all actors to show restraint.
He says some EU member states have asked for sanctions against Iran to be expanded in response to Tehran's attack on Israel.
After this meeting, we will increase our outreach with the key partners in the region, and some member states propose the adoption of expand the restrictive measures against Iran.
A At the weekend, the United States and other military allies came to the aid of Israel and shot down more than 350 exploding drones and missiles that Iran sent towards Israel. Amin Saikal is a professor of Middle Eastern, Central Asian and Islamic Studies at ANU. He thinks Benjamin Netanyahu should acknowledge that help by listening to their pleas for de-escalation.
And I think the Biden administration, of course, the British administration, they've already saying that and basically trying to tell Israel that, yes, you won that fight because you've been able to shoot down 99% of the missiles and drones. But also, there is a clear indication that the United States and Britain played a big role in that. And therefore, you have to listen to us and what we say in terms of opening the door for a big war with Iran.
He says today's announcement of US sanctions against Iran is another gesture to ask Israel to work with it.
They want to give assurance to Israel that, look, we are still on your side and we are prepared to level more sanctions against Iran. But whether that will persuade Netanyahu leadership, that remains to be seen. But at the moment, the objective of those sanctions is basically to calm down Netanyahu and his generals in terms of moving towards a war.
Professor Saikal says the longer the tension with Iran lingers, the more the focus comes off the war in Gaza.
The eyes are off Gaza at the moment and the plight of the Palestinian people and that enclave. Instead of really having the main game between Iran and Israel, the main focus should be on Gaza. And I think that is where the whole thing really started. And I think it is about time that Israel and all its international backers focus exclusively on how to really end the Gaza war and bring about a permanent ceasefire and use that as the basis for reaching a negotiated settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in the context of the two-state solution.
Professor Amin Saikal, who's a Middle East expert at the ANU, Rachel Mealy reporting. Police are trying to work out what caused the death of a woman who was staying at a wellness retreat in central Victoria last weekend. 53-year-old Melburnian Rachel Dixon was staying at the Soul Barn in Clunes, which is near Ballarat. It's understood she drank some sort of mushroom drink before she died. ABC reporter Cyan Valance has been in Clunes today. Cyan, what do we know about the death of Rachel Dixon?
Well, at this point, police are telling us that there were reports of a woman who was unconscious on Saturday. The first people who were alerted were locals via the Good Sam app. So basically it just alerts people with first aid training that somebody needs help. So a few locals went down and performed CPR before paramedics arrived. But even though they tried desperately for, we understand, around half an hour, Rachel Dixon couldn't be saved and actually died there at the scene.
And what are police saying about this mushroom drink that she's apparently ingested?
Well, they're staying very tight-lipped because it is preparing a report for the coroner for. At this point, we do understand that it was a mushroom drink, but we don't know the cause of death. So even though it was drunk just before she died, we can't confirm that that is how she died. We did talk to a toxicologist today who said that, yes, one mushroom can cause immediate death, but that he doesn't know of one that will cause a cardiac arrest like this. So police are being very cautious. They are waiting for all of the results to come back and then they'll prepare a report for the coroner before we know exactly what was in that drink and whether it did in fact contribute to her death.
So there's no word on what type of mushrooms were in the drink?
No, not at this point.
And how many people also drank that drink and were they affected?
Well, we understand that there was a group of people at this event and that two other women were taken to hospital. They were discharged pretty soon afterwards. And one of the first responders we spoke to said that that was really a precaution and it was really only Rachel Dixon who had this really severe reaction.
Now, this happened at a wellness retreat in Clunes. You've been in the area today. What kind of services does it provide?
Well, Soulbarn is sort of sold as this holistic retreat. So basically it's a store that sells all sorts of crystals and wellness sort of merchandise. They also run sound healing. There are massages and facials and those sort of treatments. But they did actually post a statement on social media today saying that they have deep sorrow and shock and that Soulbarn hires out the workshop space to external businesses. And that's what's actually happened on Saturday night. So none of their staff were involved with what happened or any of their regular therapists. But the store will remain closed while police investigate just what's gone so tragically wrong.
And Sian, this has been a really tough time for the little town of Clunes. Local woman Hannah Maguire was allegedly murdered by her former partner recently. What's the mood like in town? What are people saying?
Oh, people are just shocked. This is a town of 1,700 people. So they're used to it being quiet, but this has absolutely rocked them. We spoke with the mayor today. He said that the council is offering free counselling services because also in this community over the past few years, they've seen fires, they've seen floods just nearby in Dalesford. They had that horrific crash in November that saw five people lose their lives. And so they've learned from that that the trauma isn't always immediate. Sometimes it can happen up to 6 months afterwards that people are hit. You know, at the moment, people are sort of feeling adrenaline. They've rushed to help. But now, as it gets more quiet, they just want to make sure that everyone's okay. He says the community is very resilient, and that's what we picked up from talking to everyone. And they're rallying together, really supporting, especially the business owner, who is shocked and devastated herself. But, yeah, this is a time they are really just coming together to support each other, but also that extra support's there for them if they need it.
ABC reporter Sian Valance, who's been in Clunes in central Victoria today. Well, it might feel like a lifetime ago now, but the early results of Australia's massive COVID vaccine rollout are under scrutiny again today. A new study by researchers at RMIT and Monash universities has found that in New South Wales alone, the vaccination campaign likely prevented more than 17,000 deaths in the over 50 age group. Associate Professor Hassan Valley is an epidemiologist at Deakin. He told David Sparks the findings show just how important the vaccines have been.
I think we can take it as a very good approximation of the success of the vaccination program. I think those figures are amazing. And if you do the maths, I think the figures they quote are there was a 7.7-fold greater mortality in those that were unvaccinated compared to those that were fully vaccinated. And that rose up to 11.2-fold greater mortality when you compared it with those people who had the vaccination with the booster dose. So they're extraordinary figures that I guess confirm what, a lot of us have been saying for a long time, that vaccinations were crucial in terms of how successfully we navigated the pandemic.
Would this estimation of deaths prevented, that's over 17,000, take into account not only the added susceptibility if someone's unvaccinated, but also, I guess, the snowball effect of hospital beds becoming full and therefore people not receiving treatment as they did as it happened?
I think we have to be really careful here that the approach that these investigators took was a very simple approach. And so there are a lot of, probably a lot of the complexities of the interactions that you're talking to that may not have been accounted for. But I guess the most important thing to say is in not taking into account those complexities and those nuances, this estimate is almost certainly an underestimate.
Really?
Yes. I think when you take into account those indirect effects, you're probably going to get a much bigger number.
To what extent does it irk you that there are still people out there in the community who dismiss
the importance of these of those COVID vaccines?
It's hard to put it into words, to be honest. I, you know, people like me who've commentated in the media, we get contacted all the time, and people share their views in terms of some of the misinformation out there about vaccines. And it is really frustrating because vaccines in general are one of the most amazing advances of modern society and have saved hundreds of millions of lives even before COVID. And they saw us through the pandemic and saved, you know, millions of lives globally. So it's hard to overstate how important vaccines are.
Associate Professor Hassan Valley from Deakin Uni. He was speaking to David Sparks. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily Podcast. It's been an unsettling few days with two major knife crimes in Sydney. So, what's going on? Today, an extremism expert on what we know about the latest attack on a church in Sydney's west and the importance of social cohesion in tense times. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on the ABC Listen app.